This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
In this program, during global heat records, a world-scale carbon burst is still pouring out of Canada's northern wildfires, bigger than the emissions of most countries. Explore with Professor Justin Angle, author of This Is Wildfire, How to Protect Yourself, Your Home, and Your Community in the Age of Heat. Then, Rethinking the Big Picture, Adrian Carr's new work, Earthlings, Imaginative Encounters with the Natural World. Hi, I'm Alex. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. No doubt you heard the hot news. September and early October smashed heat records around the world, and not just by a little. Normally reserved climate scientist Zeke Hausfather said, "This month was, in my professional opinion as a climate scientist, absolutely gobsmackingly bananas." The Japanese reanalysis found September 2023 beat the prior monthly record by over half a degree centigrade and was around 1.8 degrees C warmer than pre-industrial levels. So this September was half a degree centigrade hotter than any temperature ever recorded for the month. We've never seen such a big heat jump. Earth sailed past the supposed 1.5 degrees C safety guardrail for at least that month. Many of you lived through it. How great to get summer weather in October. Back to the beaches. Unless, of course, you are a plant, an animal, or a farmer who depends on growing seasons. European countries sizzled. Poland was 4 degrees warmer than the previous hottest September. Switzerland, where 10% of the glaciers in the Alps melted in the last 2 years alone, it was 3.8 degrees C hotter. France was 3.6, along with the Czech Republic, Hungary, and Austria. The Caribbean experienced record-breaking heat. And then Professor Elliot Jacobson says the most extreme global temperature anomalies going on right now are in the tropics, where the temperatures are averaging about 0.7 degrees C above the recent 1991 to 2020 baseline, end quote. Weather historian Maximiliano Herrera reports on October 6th, "The Middle East in rewriting world climate history yesterday, new national October records, Iran 46.6 at Bandar el-Dair, Oman 45.2 at Hamra ad-Daru. The world's hottest minimum temperature for an October night was recorded this week in Abu al-Bukush, in the United Arab Emirates. If that 33.9 degrees C nighttime low, 93 degrees Fahrenheit, is officially confirmed, we have a new nighttime high for October on this planet. It was 33 degrees C in the capital of Doha overnight as well. Just imagine. September 2023 in Peru, says Herrera, was record hot and also witnessed the highest temperatures in its climatic history. The October heat was cooking and breaking records across northern South America in countries like Bolivia, Guyana, and more. It was all over. Eastern China broke October heat records, and you know Japan has been baking in a heat wave lasting months. It is surrounded by seas hotter by far than anything seen before. And it is not just the northern hemisphere. According to Herrera, who is a climatologist, September 2023 in New Zealand had an average temperature of 11.9 degrees C, which is 1.3 degrees C above the 1991-2020 normal, and was the warmest September on records. Australia is already very hot, and it's early in the spring. A few fires already sprang up in New South Wales. The Australian Bureau of Meteorology just released its forecast for this El Niño year. Australians should expect 3 months of dry, blistering heat in their summer. The conditions mirror the great fire times of the last El Niño in 2015-2016. This looks like another tough summer of awful headlines for our Australian friends. You get the idea. Earth just experienced a new jump in heat. We don't know how long it will last, what it will change, what it means. Models did not predict this. Scientists are scrambling to find out why. Professor Stefan Rahmstorf, a trusted source, tweets, We do understand the global warming caused by fossil fuels. For four decades, it has been going as predicted. But we don't understand the surprise upward leap that is happening now, and that worries me, end quote, from Stefan Rahmstorf. Me too. Despite producing a dozen programs this year about abrupt climate change and the fragility of Earth's systems, I find myself shocked, sad, and out of words. Why didn't scientists see this big jump in global temperatures coming? Well, a few did. James Hansen, working with records of how temperatures go up to a new plateau with each El Niño, predicted, quote, that 2024 is likely to be off the chart as the warmest year on record, end quote. But even Hansen did not see a huge jump in temperature in 1 month this soon at the start of October in both hemispheres. Regular listeners have heard various guests on this show talk about the possibility of sudden, surprising, abrupt climate change. I've focused on the instability of the system since spring. We did not see this in the past. We are in a brand new situation. So Michael Mann, the inventor of the famous hockey stick and the climate warrior, has a new book out. He's doing interviews, and he is selling hope, even of 1.5 degrees for the future. Well, we may breach that this year or the next. Mann criticizes doomers who will discourage the public, even if they do turn out to be right. Perhaps scientists should not tell the public the whole frightening truth because they will lose hope and then, well, we'll all just party with fossil fuel power until we drop. We're doing that anyway. But I strongly disagree with Dr. Mann as much as I respect him. Tell the truth to anyone who will listen. This is Radio EcoShock.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org.
Also in October, smoke from Canadian wildfires clouded the air over Miami, about 3,000 kilometers or 1,900 miles away from the megafires in Ontario and Quebec. Those fires started in May and will keep going until deep snow puts them out, assuming winter comes. The wildfires are worse in Canada's north, like British Columbia, Alberta, and the Northwest Territories. Greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide are pouring out of those vast burning trees right into the atmosphere. None of that is included in the comforting forecasts coming from the politicians and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Fire is in the driver's seat. Record-setting megafires scorched North America this summer. These fires released more greenhouse gases than most countries of the world. They burned thousands of homes and forced tens of thousands of people to evacuate. Harmful fire smoke covered continents. What a perfect time for a clear, down-to-earth fire manual for us all. It is called This is Wildfire: How to Protect Yourself, Your Home, and Your Community in the Age of Heat. The authors are Montana journalist and award-winning podcaster Nick Mott and fellow public radio broadcaster Professor Justin Angle. He is from the University of Montana. Their podcast and radio show is called Fireline. The new book is full of helpful tips with a message that will be controversial for some of you. From Missoula, Montana, Justin Angle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Good to be here with you.
Justin, your life is sort of complicated. You were a triathlon athlete in New England, then with a finance master's degree, a bond trader, and now?
My life has sort of had a few different distinct phases. You know, I studied business as a college student and got into the bond markets and then did a stint as a rowing coach because I was a rower as a student. You know, that experience taught me that working on campus was something I wanted to do, so I went back to graduate school and earned a PhD and landed here as a business professor. Now, that still doesn't draw a clean line to why I was involved in wildfire, in a wildfire book, but here in Missoula, Montana, we sit at an epicenter for wildfire science, fire management, fire fighting, and fire is part of this community, and much important work is being done here, and I wanted to understand it. And as I set out to try to understand it, it became clear that few citizens, you know, in this area, but also in the country in general, had really an understanding of how we got to this place we're at with wildfire and how we move forward. And so the opportunity to collaborate with Nick on the Fireline podcast came about. That podcast was well received, and it led to this book opportunity. So not exactly a straight line to where I am today, but it's been a fun ride.
And you're in a good place now. Well, at Harvard, Professor Richard Wrangham suggested mastering fire could be essential to human evolution. How so?
Yeah, so Richard Wrangham, in his book, Chasing Fire, and, you know, we came across Richard through his book and had the opportunity to interview him for Fireline, but he was one of the first anthropologists to propose the theory that the moment we became human was the moment that we learned how to control fire. And the mechanism through which that worked was by being able to control fire, we were able to cook our food. And cooking our food allowed for us to ingest the sort of calories we'd need to fuel a big brain, the big brain that modern human beings have. And so that basic evolutionary moment, or that basic moment of ingenuity by early primates, set in motion an evolutionary process that led to, you know, what modern humans are today. And in some ways, it's kind of ironic that, you know, our attempt to control fire sort of also led to an obsession with burning that has done many things to contribute to climate change and the moment we're at with wildfire and other natural disasters that our planet's experiencing.
Your book contains chapters about how to make a home more fire-resistant and community organizing both before and after a fire. And speaking of that, intense and deadly fires are popping up in unexpected places like Greece and Hawaii. Justin, have we come to the point where every community and government needs a wildfire plan?
I think every community should have a wildfire plan. It's just a good exercise for a community to go through, to think about the critical risks, to think about its infrastructure, its policies, how safe its communities are as far as entry and exit and evacuation plans and so forth, and how fuels are managed in the community. Because to your point, yes, I think we're seeing fires in places that we haven't expected them. We're seeing them happen at times of the year where they have not historically happened, at least not in recent history. So we have a built environment that much of it has not been constructed with wildfire in mind. And I think the more communities that start considering wildfire, the stronger those communities will be when and if fire comes their way.
So you do cover climate change in fires, and we will get to that. But first, you try to overcome a mass misunderstanding about the role of fire in Western forests. What was the situation, say, in California, before the European settlers arrived?
First of all, indigenous folks have been using fire and lived in conjunction with fire for millennia and managed wildfire. They didn't view it as, they viewed it as something to be respected as part of nature, as a gift in many ways, and they introduced fire onto the landscape. The historical record shows this. And they did it in a way that helped the ecosystem stay in balance. It helped them prepare their grounds for ceremony, but also for agriculture and rejuvenation. So there's been a long tradition of, you know, intentional burning on the landscape for long before European settlers were here. And natural fire was allowed to play a role on the landscape in a way that might seem unfamiliar to folks now. You know, we hear of fire years that burn, 10 million acres here in the U.S., and that's considered a giant fire year. And by recent standards, those are really large fire years. But before European settlement, parts of the West in particular, a 10 million acre fire year was not considered to be such a large number. It wasn't out of the ordinary. So, it's really the rise of fire suppression that has reduced the amount of fire on the landscape. And what we're living through now is kind of some of the consequence of putting out all that fire, because there's actually a deficit of fire in our system. And we can talk about that a little bit more if you'd like.
I'm sure we will get to that. That's a key point in the book. But could you just explain a bit more about indigenous fire management and what that might suggest for today?
Absolutely. So we had the great privilege of spending an afternoon with the late Tony Incashola Sr. and his son Tony Incashola Jr., who are two members of the Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribe, and they live north of Missoula in on the Flathead Indian Reservation. Sr. was long part of the culture committee, and Jr. Is in charge of fire management for the tribes. And they described some of that history, and they did so by taking us to this particular place called the Jocko Prairie. It's an area, a riparian area. It's sort of in the foothills of some large mountains adjacent to some really dense, lush forest. And for many, many years, this land was fire was excluded from this landscape. Kind of the European standard of suppressing all fires was the standard on this piece of land. And the land had become quite unhealthy, unappealing, choked with debris. Cattle were grazing on that land, so that was another factor that led to it being out of balance. And historically, the tribe had used fire and had lived in conjunction with fire. It was not viewed as something to be afraid of, and it was not viewed as something to be put out. And so elders in the tribe advocated to reintroduce fire to the landscape, and it was a long process to try to do that. And what I mean by introducing fire to the landscape, it's sort of the intentional introduction of fire, so setting fire intentionally. And, you know, and we can get into the mechanics of that. But in terms of this particular piece of land, you know, you get buy-in from the tribes, buy-in from the community, and introduced a prescribed burn, a low-intensity burn that cleared out a lot of the underbrush, a lot of the trees that were being overshadowed by larger trees. And the forest quickly became much more healthy. The larger trees that withstood the fire, I mean, they had been adapted to withstand fire. Large ponderosas, for example, they became more healthy. The understory became easier to move through, much more in balance.
Well, let's move to climate and the fires that we're seeing. Does science show that wildfires are increasing in the United States, say, even since 1980? And has the nature of those fires changed as well?
Yeah, so the first thing is we got to think about how we measure fire. So in terms of acres burned, the number of acres burned has been growing over the last 10 to 15 years, and there's some variation in there. The number of fire starts has not changed in a meaningful way over the last 20 years. We're experiencing about the same number of fire starts on an annual basis. Fires are getting more destructive, though. So the fires that do escape suppression efforts grow larger and burn hotter and can spread more quickly than they used to be. Fire seasons are longer. Fire season now is about 80 days longer than it was 30 years ago. And you know, rather than calling it a fire season, we might just call it a fire year. You know, one of the most devastating wildfires in the United States happened over New Year's, essentially, the Marshall Fire outside of Boulder, Colorado. So, yeah, we're experiencing fires at different times of the year. The fires are more intense and they're more destructive. And one of the key reasons they're more destructive, and this is important to keep in mind, is that we've built more and more homes and more structures in places that are prone to burning. So, you know, it's not that these places are burning in unprecedented ways necessarily. It's just that we've happened to build a lot of our homes in these places, and that's the primary cause of the destruction rather than the fire itself, if you think about it from that perspective. But yeah, there's a few different dimensions to how to quantify fire. Acres burned is not necessarily the best dimension, but on several measures, the intensity and overall volume of fires has certainly increased.
And do we have the science to directly link some of those changes to climate change, to heating the planet with burning fossil fuels?
Yeah, the science has a pretty simple intuition, and that intuition is the warmer the temperature, the more fires we have. We talked to a climate scientist at Montana State University, Kathy Whitlock, and she explained one of the methods that her and her colleagues used to document this relationship. And so they drill down into the bottom of lakes and pull out these long tubes that are called sediment cores. So by looking at a sample of the sediment at the bottom of the lake, it's like an historical record of the climate. And you can see, you know, based on the pollens that they detect, you know, what sorts of plants were growing. And if you know what type of plants are growing, you know what kind of temperature range was happening. And if you know the temperature range, you also see evidence of fire in this core when you see, you know, different patterns of charcoal. The science shows that the warmer the temperatures on the planet, the more fires we have. That's the simple intuition. You know, one of the reasons that that plays out is this concept called vapor pressure deficit. So when the air is hotter, when the temperature is higher, more moisture is drawn out of the system, vegetation is drier, both the vegetation that's living and also the vegetation that has, you know, is dead on the ground. All of that is fuel. And if the fuel is drier, if conditions are warmer, then you're going to have more fire. In fact, Kathy and her colleagues told us that we're actually in what's called a fire deficit, that based on the temperatures that we're experiencing, we should actually have more fire than we have now. And we can talk about why we don't, but that's just something that listeners should be aware of, is based on, you know, the warming that we're experiencing, that we should expect more fire to be in the system.
With every big season, social media and even mainstream media blare about arsonists setting fire, but most of the fires, at least here in Canada, almost 99 out of 100, were started by lightning storms, not arson. So you looked into why humans dwell on simplistic explanations. Why is the arsonist conspiracy so popular, and is it a kind of fire or climate denial?
Oh, man, I don't know if it's necessarily fire or climate denial. It's climate denial in the sense that, you know, if people say that arson is becoming, you know, more rampant, that that can excuse us from thinking that the climate is driving any of the increase in fires. I think the arson, whether you want to classify it as a conspiracy or an explanation or this sort of obsession and attention that arson gets, because it provides us with an easy culprit, right? If we can blame the actions of a single person as one bad actor, we don't then have to consider the broader instability in our system. And if we think of arsons as the proximal cause of our fire problem, we just need to lock up all the arsonists, right? And that's kind of a simple thought process. But if we have to think about, like, whoa, you know, the climate's changed and we've built our homes in places they maybe shouldn't be built, and we've built with materials and designs and constructed our neighborhoods in risky ways, you know, those are much bigger sort of look-in-the-mirror type of problems that are much harder to address with solutions.
Right. Well, a central theme in This is Wildfire is bound to be controversial. You argue, with some science to back it up, that we should fight fire with fire. What is a prescribed burn association?
A prescribed burn association is something that we're seeing more of across the West and in southwestern United States and some areas in the middle parts of the continent as well. It's a collection of local landowners that want to introduce fire onto their land. You know, and it's not uncommon for private landowners to, you know, slash piles and burn those piles. It's a pretty common thing, at least here in Montana, and certainly other places I've traveled to. But doing it at a scale that manages the level of fuel on a landscape, that tries to return a forest to some balance, that tries to simulate the role that periodic wildfire historically played on the landscape, doing that at a scale where it has an impact on the health of an ecosystem is difficult. And it takes coordination, it takes training, it takes management. It's a hard thing for any one landowner to do, both pragmatically and in terms of the regulations and so forth. The agencies, at least here in the States, say they want to introduce more prescribed burning on federal and state lands. That's really hard to do. And the only agency that's been able to increase its burning has been the Bureau of Indian Affairs. So an alternative model that's arisen are these prescribed burning associations, which are, like I said, these localized organizations that are trying to do this at a scale that can affect their local ecosystems. And it's a pretty successful model. I mean, we don't want any individual landowners just going out and setting fire to their property without the right resources, training, and safety measures put in place. And so these associations are a mechanism that seems promising as a way to introduce more fire onto the landscape and, you know, allow fire to play more of its natural role in the ecosystem.
But this sets up a basic paradox. A few years back, we had Swiss scientist Thomas Crowther on Radio EcoShock, and he explained planting billions of trees could reduce overall global warming. And some countries are planting trees on a massive scale. But is that offset by more purposeful burning in North America? Why plant trees in some places and burn trees in others?
I mean, that's a complicated question, and there's a lot of competing interest. Yes, fire releases carbon into the atmosphere, and wildfire smoke can be a big contributor to greenhouse gases. Or wildfire smoke, it is a greenhouse gas. There needs to be balance. The cause of climate change, in many ways, is not wildfire smoke. It's, you know, industrialized burning. It's the cars and factories and other sources of carbon. I think those are probably the sorts of emissions that we should be thinking about more than how to limit wildfire smoke. Because if we plant or just allow forests to be overgrown, you know, that's potential energy in the system. You know, as we saw with the Northern Canadian fires this summer, like once those fires get going in those dense forests, it's near impossible to suppress. So if we're thinking about planting trees to, you know, create carbon offsets, you know, that's a useful mechanism, right? I'm not against trees, but I do think we need to consider the potential risks that that introduces to a system. Are those forests healthy? Are they resilient to burning? Are they planted solely for the purpose of offsetting carbon and not with some sort of natural order in mind? Meaning, are they too dense, maybe too risky as far as the potential for wildfire? Like if a wildfire comes to one of those specifically planted forests, is it natural enough to be resilient to fire on its own? Or is it, or are we going to be able to manage a fire in that area if it ever arises? These are hard trade-offs. Without clear answers one way or the other.
Oh, no doubt our listeners would like to hear how they could make their own homes and communities less likely to burn down. What are your top tips, Justin Engel?
Yeah, I think there's a lot we can do to make our homes more resilient to wildfire. And I think the first step in that process is for folks to understand what's the most likely way their house could catch fire. Often in the media, we see portrayals of, you know, huge flames overtaking a home. And that's rarely the way that a home ignites. There's research by a retired Forest Service scientist named Jack Cohen. And he was a pioneer of understanding that the biggest risk to a home is actually a floating ember. And that ember can be wafted from a fire, you know, up to miles away. And that embers tend to find weak spots on your home. That weak spot could be some debris in a gutter. It could be some leaves in a little crevice on your roof. It could be a wooden roof. It could be firewood or scrap wood stacked up under a deck. It could be anything that's flammable that's touching your house. These embers find weak spots, and then your home ignites. If you conceptualize your home as fuel for a fire, then it helps you think about ways to make it more resilient. Cleaning those gutters, getting any vegetation back from the home, surrounding the home maybe with gravel instead of mulch. If you have a wooden roof, be thinking about ways to get rid of that. That is a big expense for many, and I think here in the States, and I'm not sure how it works in Canada, but I think some public investment to help people with wooden roofs replace those roofs, particularly if they're at high-risk zones, is worth consideration. But thinking of, you know, your home and the immediate area around it as a space you need to defend and make it more resilient to wildfire, that can go a long way to protect a home. A lot of folks saw images from the fire in Lahaina in Maui. Now, I got questions often about the so-called miracle home there and why one home was able to survive when everything around it was just burned to the ground. And, you know, there's probably a measure of luck involved in the survival of that home. But if you look at the pictures of that home, you'll immediately notice that it has a rather new-looking metal roof. It's a metal roof that was installed in 2021. You'll also notice that there's no vegetation immediately touching the home or within several feet of it. And there's gravel landscaping around that home. So that home had a lot of defenses built into it, and those defenses probably contributed to its survival. So the key insight there is there's things you can do to harden your home, and there's resources like wildfirerisk.org.